Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Dill, Jason Croft, is at the controls. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. You can go back and hear some programs that you might have missed or like to hear some again, or you'd like to sign up for our podcast, just go to our website. It's will, that's W-I-L-L, will.illinois.edu. Early last year, oil was selling for under $60 a barrel. Last week, the per barrel price was over $135, and some people have predicted that within the next couple of years, the price could go as high as $200 a barrel. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll take a look at some of the factors that determine the price of oil, talk a little bit about why recently it has gone up so far so fast, and perhaps think about what we can expect in the near term. And our guest for the program is Amy Myers Jaffe. She is the Wallace S. Wilson Fellow in Energy Studies at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy and Associate Director of the Rice University Energy Program. In her research, she focuses on oil geopolitics, on strategic energy policy, and energy economics. She served as a member of the Reconstruction and Economy Working Group of the Baker-Hamilton Iraq Study Group. She also served as an advisor to the U.S. National Intelligence Council Study on Energy to 2015 and as project director of the Baker Institute Council on Foreign Relations Task Force on Strategic Energy Policy. Currently, she serves as strategic advisor to the American Automobile Association of the U.S., helping the Motor Club fashion a voice for the American motorist in the U.S. energy policy debate. And before joining the Baker Institute, she was the senior editor and Middle East analyst for Petroleum Intelligence Weekly. Questions are certainly welcome as we talk. We only ask people to keep their questions brief, just so we can get in as many callers as possible and keep things moving along. But of course, questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois or Indiana. In fact, across the country, if you're listening on the internet, the local number is 333-9455, and the toll-free is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, you are certainly welcome to give us a call. Professor Jaffe, hello.
Hey, good morning.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. There are a lot of things that I certainly want to talk about, and I'd like to, among those things, we want to talk about the various factors that all enter into determining the price of oil. But something else that is on people's minds is what's likely to happen here with the price in the near term, at least I guess I'm thinking the rest of this year, maybe the next couple. And here is where we get into some of the numbers that people have tossed out. Now, it's back below $130 now, but it within the past few weeks, looking at the recent price spike, some people have said, don't be surprised if this year we say $150 a barrel. And there are people who have gone as far as to say, within the next couple of years, we could see $200 a barrel. What do you think about that?
Well, there are really two distinct camps. Either one of them could be right, so I'll give your listeners something to look for. This $200 scenario, in my opinion, it would take a catalyst. In other words, the Bush administration gets out of control and attacks Iran, or we see some huge turnaround in violence in Iraq, or some kind of conflagration between Israel, Lebanon, and Iran, some kind of real escalation in the Middle East. I think it would take to really jazz the market up to the 200. I just don't see that happening naturally. For your listeners, just so you know what's my pocketbook reference point, a $200 oil price translates, if you look at the historical relationship between crude oil and retail gasoline in the United States, that's about a $6.65 a gallon tab at your local gasoline station. So I see that as an extreme, and I personally believe that we're in sort of a speculative bubble market, and what's my evidence of that? My evidence of that is that we have sort of what I call distressed inventory. So you'd have to be in the oil market as a trader to know this, but take the country of Iran in the spring. That is a time when oil refineries sometimes shut down temporarily for maintenance in Asia, And so because of that, the Iranians had so much trouble selling their oil. They've had to store 10 giant tankers of oil just floating off their coast. And I don't believe they're holding that oil just to raise the price. I think they're holding that oil because they can't sell it. And so that's sort of inconsistent with the idea that the futures market price keeps going higher and higher. And that's why a lot of us feel that there's sort of a speculative bubble. So everybody who's a Wall Street hedge fund or your pension money or somebody who's bailing out of their subprime mortgage position, a lot of those traders are moving into what we call the inflation hedge products, gold, which we've already seen rise a lot, metals, and oil. So, you know, once you get a lot of doctors and dentists saying, hey, I'm going to put my oil in money, that's the best hedge against inflation, I'm taking my money out of treasury bills because I'm only getting 1%, that sort of drives sort of extra buying. And the oil market is a weird phenomenon. You have a lot of independent wildcatters and even the oil company executives where they're discouraged from selling their production forward. You would think at a price like $130 a barrel, you know, everybody who owned oil would be jumping in to lock in that price, but you really don't have a lot of sellers. And so the market just gets inflated, which is where I think we are today.
So if you would think that it would take something really extraordinary to get us to $200, what would you say to those people who would say, well, in fact, who might agree with you and say for a variety of reasons this spike is unusual and temporary, and that in fact I think there are some people who are also saying, well, you know, it's not unreasonable to think that in fact we might see the price get down back to what it was at the beginning of last year, like around 70.
Well, I mean, that is, again, a possibility, but that possibility is dependent on a change in perceptions about the market. So, first of all, players have to decide that the market risk of the Middle East is greatly reduced. So if we saw more constructive dialogue between the United States and Iran on the nuclear or other issues, like Iraq, if the the so-called success of the surge, if we see a lot of people coming on TV and saying, yes, violence is down in Iraq and Saudi Arabia is comfortable and everything's stable. I mean, we just released a study at Rice University where we looked at these sort of big risk factors. Is Al-Qaeda going to blow up a big major oil installation? Are we going to have a giant conflict with Iran? What if the Russians cut off Europe for natural gas? You know, what would happen if these things happen? And we did some simulations. And one of the things we found is that there's a little less catastrophe to each of these things when you sit and analyze it. The Iranian elections actually swung against President Ahmadinejad, and actually conservative and reformist candidates did much better at the polls than they have in a long time. And since there's more dialogue between those two groups, one might predict, because one never likes to make predictions with Iran, but, I mean, one might predict a much more pragmatic government stance as time goes on, one that might even entertain a negotiation for ending enrichment. So as a risk factor, that's actually less risky today than it was a year ago. Same thing with Al-Qaeda. In 2004, when we saw them attack Saudi oil facilities in 2006, there were a lot of pronouncements of leadership strategic figures on the Internet calling on the faithful, you know, issuing a fatwa saying, blowing up and destroying the oil of the Middle East is now game. It's legitimate. We have to deprive. It's much more important to deprive this oil from the evil West and their puppets in the Middle East than to save the oil for ourselves later on. And we did get some sort of suicide missions, but the interesting thing about those is that they have been relatively unsuccessful because the sort of international structure that allowed a lot of the coordination that pulled off September 11 attacks, a lot of that has been dismantled, and you have these sort of suicide cells. And because these oil facilities are a big and highly guarded target, it's going to be just so much harder for them to be successful. So, again, given the roundups and interventions you've had in places like Saudi Arabia, and given the sort of quieting of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Again, I think that there's probably less of a risk today than there was, say, a year or two ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, obviously, the prediction is a difficult business. But if we say that it would take something really extraordinary for us to have a bigger bump up than we've seen, up above $150, but for some other reasons, maybe we'll talk about particularly high demand and the ability to meet demand, then maybe should we expect that maybe it'll be around, maybe it'll go down some, but it won't go down to the levels that we saw it last year. So should we not be surprised if we see the price of oil continue to be, I don't know, maybe around $100 a barrel?
Yeah, I think that is the sort of, you know, favorite scenario. And part of that is that there are players, take the airlines or others, that just aren't going to be willing to take the chance. You know, to have the market really collapse to 60, which, you know, could happen suddenly. So, for example, if your listeners hear that the real estate market is down another 10 or 20% and that is causing the banking community to be out of the money on their subprime mortgage derivative products, right? Mm-hmm. And you're going to have another little, you know, Bear Stearns-like, you know, financial catastrophe. Well, something like that could trigger all those people who are from the banking world holding commodities to have to pull their money out. Then we could definitely get to $60. But it'd have to be some kind of a financial crisis like that. If you're talking about sort of the status quo, we're in a slow burn to a recession, we're seeing oil demand go down, people drove less Memorial Day weekend, say that continues, which I think would be likely. And so you're going to see oil demand slipping in Europe, in Japan, in the United States. I disagree with a lot of the experts. The idea that somehow China and India is going to be immune to that trend and we're never going to get to the point where demand is not rising in those countries, I just don't see that. If the American banking community and other kinds of businesses in the United States start to lose money or fire workers, they're certainly also going to cut their outsourcing contracts, and they're not going to be manufacturing as much in China and India, and so that's going to hurt those economies as well. And any kind of financial problems we have in our banking system through the subprime and other kinds of banking counterparty risk, that's going to affect Chinese banks, and they're probably in a worse position than the American banks, which are highly capitalized and don't have a lot of, you know, badly performing loans. So, or maybe not to the extent that maybe is hidden in the Chinese system. So this idea, which you hear from even really established organizations like the International Energy Agency, this idea that somehow the Chinese are recession-proof and their economy can only grow, and that they can only use more gasoline, I just don't see that. The Chinese have put in higher, you know, car efficiency standards than we have. They have in the past just absolutely banned imports. They've just said, okay, for the next 2 months we can't pay for them, so nobody can import in any oil. So they have a lot tougher mechanisms they can use than we are willing to stomach politically. So I just don't see that scenario, and that's why it's hard to sell against the market. I mean, I'd be afraid to sell against the market because, like I say, you know, some kind of summer flare-up in the Middle East and you'd have lost everything you owned. But this long-term idea that demand will just stay up no matter how high the price is and that Asian countries will just offer their citizens fuel subsidies no matter what the bill, that's not correct. And so once they start to respond and our economy slows and Americans drive less or move themselves if they can into a smaller car, we're already seeing that happening, then you are going to see some pressure on the oil price.
We have a caller here I want to get right to, and for anybody who has just tuned in, I'd like to introduce again our guest, Amy Myers Jaffe. She is the Wallace Wilson Fellow in Energy Studies at James Baker Institute for Public Policy. She's also Associate Director of the Rice University Energy Program and does research on oil geopolitics, international relations, U.S. foreign policy, strategic energy policy. We're talking about oil, how we account for the recent run-up in the price, what we can expect in the future. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here we have a caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
My question would be, could she speculate on what was said or decided in the meetings that Dick Cheney had with the oil executives and for the energy policy they did, I think that was before 9/11, and what effects that has had on the prices over time. Thanks.
All right.
Okay, well, I would say that the Cheney Task Force put out, I've seen it, it's a very thick study. I'm tempted to say it's 1,000 or 2,000 pages. I would say the upshot of that was basically nothing. They, of course, recommended we drill in Alaska, which was not able to pass the Congress. The tax breaks and insurance extended to the nuclear industry in 2005, which was a big Cheney thing, right? We have to favor nuclear power. Remember, he mentioned this number of plants he wanted to see constructed in the United States, which was terribly unrealistic. The Congress passed enough economic support that there should be room for three new nuclear plants to be constructed and, you know, sort of get the public's nickel to help them out. And that was in 2005. We're 2008. There are several plants proposed, and none of them have fully permitted or broken ground. So that has been a very, very slow process, even with, these new laws that limit red tape and try to fast-track it and provide some background insurance. Moving to the nuclear option has proven to be very, very difficult, and construction costs for existing plants that are being built in other countries are being, double and triple what people were expecting the construction costs to be, so people are very cautious about how much of a potential nuclear has. And a lot of the other things that were in that report are very boilerplate, going out and making sure we have diverse suppliers and so forth and doing good diplomacy in that regard. We have been singly unsuccessful. The Bush administration started off with some big successes in Russian diplomacy. We saw the Russian Far East, the Sakhalin Islands, new deals for American companies and new production. But since then, since the first term, it's been a slow hill down. And many of the policies we've tried going back and sort of freeing up oil and gas from Turkmenistan. Russians went and made their own deal. We have been somewhat unsuccessful in maintaining our relationships in a lot of different places. We're in a bad or worse relationship with Venezuela, which is a major supplier to the United States. We're nowhere further in helping Mexico reform and reorganize its sector to be able to produce and meet increasing demand, not only in Mexico, but also at least be able to maintain their exports to the United States. So Mexico's on this sort of path, in my opinion, to being a net importer of oil and natural gas. We are no further along to settling the dispute with Iran. We have not opened up new areas for exploration, not too much, a little bit in the U.S. Gulf of Mexico, a little bit of acreage in Alabama and Florida, but not too much. So we really made progress in almost nothing, and Cheney cannot take credit for the 2007 bill, which was really Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats who finally got us a decent progress, but not as much as we could do. On corporate efficiency standards for American automobiles.
All right, let's talk with somebody else. This is a caller in White Heath. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I was calling because I was watching C-SPAN the other day, and a Michael Greenberger was on, who was a former Commodities Futures Trading Commissioner. And he and George Soros, among others, apparently, are going to be in the in front of the Senate next week, talking about speculation and in the oil business and hedge fund trading, and that's one of the reasons that the price of fuel is or the price of oil is so high. And then I was following something else on the internet about Senator Graham back in 1999. Or maybe it was a different, I don't know exactly the year. He changed the law easing regulation of energy commodity trading, which not only brought about, maybe brought about Enron problems, but could maybe be affecting our oil prices. How do you feel about all those things?
Well, there is this very vicious cycle lock between the dollar and oil prices. In other words, as the dollar, and it's beyond just the speculative markets and exchanges in the United States, so as the dollar weakens, and it's very circular. So we have to import more oil every time the dollar weakens, right? And it costs us, let me rephrase that. We're buying more and more oil because we're using more and more oil. As the price of oil goes up, that means our trade deficit goes up. That puts more pressure on the U.S. dollar. As the U.S. dollar sinks, people who are oil producers, like the Saudi Arabias and Irans, to stay in the same place with goods they would buy, say, in Europe that would be priced in euros, or in Asia that would be priced in the yuan or in the yen, they need more. Oil is priced in dollars, so they need more dollars to buy the same amount of things just to stay in the same place. So I don't know where it is quite now, but at about $125 oil, if you work that back to 2002 dollar value in the euro, it was still about $70 or $80 oil, if you corrected for the currency movement. So we're in this sort of vicious circle. The lower the dollar goes, the more the oil producers are going to want the price, and then the more that creates a higher U.S. trade deficit, which, of course, puts more pressure on the dollar, and then you're going to wrap the speculators into that process. So if I have to worry about inflation, my hedge against inflation is to buy oil. So the problem with regulating it is it's very hard. I mean, you yourself or maybe somebody you know has a retirement account, and you would want your money manager to be able to best hedge you against inflation. And if he thought that meant that he should be buying you an oil stock or he should be buying you a commodity fund, you don't want to say that he doesn't have the right to do that, because there's a fundamental need in the market for that. But where we get problems is, you mentioned the Enron debacle. What happened in Enron? What happened in Enron is people gamed the market. In other words, people took advantage of knowing things about pipelines or turning off facilities for a short period of time to create a shortage in a particular market. And the end result was, at some limited time frame, Enron and El Paso and companies like that were making a lot of money on speculation, and there were people in the state of California who were dying because their traffic light wasn't working or because there wasn't electricity in a hospital. So there needs to be a balance between allowing the markets to function in an orderly way, to provide opportunities for an airline to hedge its fuel cost and come up with more certainty, or to have your money manager be able to protect you from inflation, and having these sort of speculative bubbles of easy credit. And so, quite frankly, if you really take the problem and analyze it backwards, at least the current problem in oil, one might say that, frankly, the Fed's easy credit policy is, part of what got us to the place we're in now. And they did that to try to avoid paying the piper. But at some point, your home, you might have been able to, refinance your home at some point, but that whole process also fed the current problems we have, where you're paying that money back, on your energy bill.
Does that get at your... I'm sorry, I had you on hold there, but I got you back on now if you wanted to follow up. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just feel that... there's just too many greedy people out there, and unless you have some kind of regulation, we look at the housing market right now with the deregulation of the investment banking and the banking. Everybody, that was also a Phil Graham legislation, and now look where that whole thing has left us. So I think we just need some regulation, because there's too many greedy people. And even though my hedge fund manager, I don't belong to a hedge fund, but if I have some investment, but I believe that there's too many out there that would rather have no regulation and just have free-for-all, and it doesn't work. in the long run. It just doesn't work.
Well, I agree with you in certain respect, especially when you mentioned some of these bills about the banking sector. I personally am uncomfortable where the place I have my savings account is trading oil, because I've been covering the oil industry as an observer or as a journalist or as a writer for 30 years, and I have seen someone, you know, some young person from a bank or some other kind of business take a position, speculative position in oil, and, you know, take down a whole company by being on the wrong side of the market. And I would hate to think that someone that would happen, and it would affect my deposit, you know, for my child's college, right? And so I do agree with you that this division of what can an investment bank do and what can a commercial bank do and who's in commodity trading and who's handling my pension money, there is this giant blur in that. And you do have a tremendous amount of contagion in markets. Not only, I mean, you know, somebody was telling me a story the other day how they invested in a Brazilian company because they're trying to diversify out of dollar-based assets. But one of the things that research has shown is that all these markets move together, and the emerging markets are no protection because if something happens in one market, it's going to fall into the other, as we saw during the Asian financial crisis in 98. So I agree with you. There definitely needs to be more regulation. And this concept, I mean, I'm not a real estate specialist, but, you know, when I was growing up, if you couldn't show that your salary covered your mortgage, you know, no one would lend you the money for that mortgage. And I sort of believe in that world where you know, collateral should not just be the inflated value of your house.
I want to thank the caller and introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in. We're just a little bit past our midpoint of this hour of focus. The guest is Amy Myers Jaffe. She's the Wallace S. Wilson Fellow in Energy Studies at the James Baker Institute for Public Policy, which is based at Rice University, where she is also Associate Director of the Rice University Energy Program. She does research on geopolitics and strategic energy policy and energy economics. We're talking about oil and what goes into determining the price. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We've talked some about a couple of the things here that are on the list, particularly if we're trying to get at this question of what's been behind the recent run-up of prices. One thing we've talked a little bit about, you've talked about, is the weak dollar. Another is speculation, or at least that is big investors with a lot of cash to invest, getting into commodities. Have you talked just a moment about demand? Because one of the things that comes up in a lot of the articles is increasing demand. We already know the demand for oil around the world is very high, but the demand continues to grow, particularly as the economies of India and China continue to develop. That certainly should be a trend that would have been predictable. Has demand really gone up that much in the last 6 to 8 months?
You know what? That is the thing that annoys me the most about the discussion on oil. In fact, demand growth has fallen in the last year. So there's still growth when you factor in China and a few of the other big developing economies, but that growth is much slower. So in past years, I mean, on the average for the last 30 years, world demand has grown at average 2%. In bumper years, it's, you know, been 3% or 4% growth. We're down probably to 1% or slightly lower growth. And that is a balance because for the countries like the United States and Europe, we're seeing demand actually falling. So you have people getting on TV and in the commentary market, and they're saying, oh, you know, there's not enough oil because demand is going to grow by 30 million barrels a day over the next 20 years, and there's no supply. Well, that is sort of the trend line. And if you look at the comparative numbers, the United States uses 33% of all transportation road fuel in the world, and China uses 5%. There are 13 million cars on the road in China. We have something like 250 or 260 million cars on the road. So, of course, if you, you know, draw a line and you say, listen, think, you know, China's population is four times the size of ours. If everybody's going to have a car, just think of how much demand that is. We're going to have a crisis. you can definitely paint that picture. And it's not unreasonable to think that the Chinese middle class, I mean, we're seeing it. More and more people want to have a car. You're seeing advertisements in Shanghai for, you know, gated communities like we have here in Houston. So that's definitely a trend line. But people, you know, get stuck in what I call the static thinking. So we played around, and I invite your listeners to come to our website because we made these frequently asked questions. Where instead of giving you a whole essay to read, which might be too tedious, we just have these questions and answers that you can flip through. And so we did different calculations. So in the United States, if everybody who commuted in America were to not commute one day a week, so either telecommuted, so in other words, stay home and work from home one day a week, or carpool with a neighbor, or take public transportation, that would reduce our demand by 20%. Which would definitely lower the price. It would definitely curtail the monopoly power of OPEC and Saudi Arabia, and it would make a huge difference. I mean, that was the president's plan for ethanol for, you know, 50 years, was that same 20%, which could be accomplished by people just driving less, maybe about 30 miles or 40 miles less a week, right? If you then fool around with what mileage your car gets. So if like the Congress is targeted, we actually got to 35 miles to the gallon. So say we did that in 2020, that'd be a reasonable time frame to feel that the fleet would turn over, right? Because people don't go out and buy a new car every year, but, you know, every 5 to 10 years people do. So on that basis, we would be able to save about 2.5 million barrels a day of oil, right? If sometime between now, say, and 2015, either one of the American companies or Nissan, which has announced they're going to do it, or Toyota, who I think, you know, quietly has been plugging away to come up with these fantastic hybrid technologies, if one of these companies came up with a plug-in hybrid electric gasoline car, so in other words, I've got my car, and I can either plug it into home or fill it up at the station, and it's going to get, you know, 50 miles to the gallon, which is what some people predict for those cars. If everybody's car got 50 miles to the gallon in the United States, that would save 7 million barrels a day of oil. So the idea that it's a static picture and that, you know, the Chinese are going to go out and buy SUVs and get 8 miles to the gallon and there's not going to be enough oil, you know, it's a possible scenario, but when you think about what happened in the 70s, you know, people say the government wasted a lot of money in the 70s on alternative energy, but it really wasn't wasted because now we're back in the same place, and a lot of those technologies are ready to go. You've got people in California with solar panels on their home that are working and they're not having to pay an electricity bill. You've got, we know how to liquefy coal. We can have electric cars if we were to choose to move in that direction. So, because the technology exists and we're making progress on the batteries. So, you know, I get on TV and I hear the commentators about this sort of, you know, death path where we're going to go to war with China over oil because there's not going to be enough. And I just feel like there's just so many other possible scenarios, but it would take having real leadership in this country, which we don't currently have. Hmm.
Well, just I was going to say real quickly, even though this is a complicated question, for those people who would still say, I hear what you're saying, and it's certainly possible for us to reduce the amount of oil that we need and we use. At the same time, we know around the world we still do depend on oil, and there is very significant demand, and there have been questions raised, particularly over the last few years, about world oil supplies, how much there is, how adequate that is to the demand, and particularly whether we have gotten at, or at least we know where most of the oil that is easy to get is, and that we're coming to a point, we may even be at a point where production is at a plateau, and that we may indeed be, there may be more oil that we could go and get, but that's going to be the more expensive oil and the difficult oil to get at, and that already we're at that place, we're at that turning point place between the easy oil and the hard oil, and then it's going to, in the future, it's not going to be too long before we're at that point where it really is going to be harder and harder and more expensive to get the oil that's left. And what do you think about that kind of scenario?
Well, let's break it down step by step because, as you said, it's a very complicated question. There is still a lot of easy oil left in the world. It's just in countries that aren't friendly to having exploration by oil companies, right? So a lot of easy oil left in Iraq, a lot of easy oil left in Saudi Arabia. There's still easy oil in Venezuela, right? And even, you know, some other places that have political problems like Nigeria, right? Hmm. So a lot of the places where that so-called cheap easy oil is, that, you know, under $10 a barrel oil is, are places that, for political above-ground risk reasons, we can't get at it, and maybe there's a national monopoly there, and they're inefficient or they have political problems. You know, Kuwait, they can't get the parliament to vote to raise production because people believe in their heads that, you know, if we hold it under the ground, it'll be worth more in the future, right? So, and you know, you have a functioning cartel. I mean, you know, OPEC gets mad at me when I call them a cartel, but, you know, hey, what? They're a cartel, right? And they have purposefully held oil off the market to raise the price. And we, the only power we have as a consuming country would be to get together with other consuming countries and lower our demand, either through technology or policy, right? So so that is definitely a problem, but it's not necessarily as geological as people make it sound, right? Maybe it's more geopolitical. Mm-hmm. But then we have a problem with our own oil companies, with the private oil companies, and we, again, did a big study at Rice, caused a big flapperoo, and, you know, Exxon's having had a shareholder meeting about this yesterday. I mean, you have companies that are spending their capital, buying back their own stock. So if you take the largest oil companies in the world, so that would be ExxonMobil, Chevron, BP, Shell, and ConocoPhillips, and you looked at their cash flow, because if you're a business, what do you have to reinvest? You have your cash flow. So their cash flow was $150 billion in 2006, and they spent $56 billion of that buying back their stock. So if you're going to hold their stock for 3 months, I suppose that's good. If their stock's in your pension, that's not good, because in the end, all of those countries, again, which we showed in this study, have had declining production, not rising production. And they say that they're opportunity constrained, but that doesn't explain why the French company Total is able to reinvest 80% of its cash flow and have rising production. It doesn't explain why a company like Marathon Oil or Devon is able to reinvest its profits and have its production profile going up and finding oil in different places through exploration. I mean, the reality is that the largest oil companies in the world have decreased their spending on exploration even as the price has gone up, right? So, again, we have a structural problem, right? What do we do to stimulate investment? I mean, you know, we all took, maybe not everybody, but probably a lot of your listeners were forced either in high school or college to take basic economics, you know, supply and demand, and we're taught this word, the price signal, right? So we're getting the price signal that oil is in short supply and prices are rising, and then we have people coming in with these forecasts that, like, everybody in China is going to have a car, and so we're not going to have enough oil, and we're at a plateau, and so forth. You would think that people would be just killing themselves to fall over themselves to drill. And the investment numbers don't show that. They don't show that in the countries that have the oil, right? They're sitting on their hands because why not just take the short-term revenue? And then in the commercial sector where Wall Street should be saying you should sell that stock because they're not investing, we're not getting that response. So there is something a little bit broken in the system. And, you know, people have made the kind of suggestions you would expect people to make. You know, you're an oil company and you want to buy back your stock, you know, maybe we'll just tax that money away and spend it on energy investment, right? Well, then the companies say, well, that's not fair because you wouldn't do that to Google. You don't, you know, and what I say to that is, listen, you know, if Google starts charging me too much money to get to their site, I can get by without doing it. If, you know, Florida orange juice becomes too expensive, you know, I can drink tap water. Right? But I can't get to work without gasoline. And there's no substitute product. I want a substitute product, and I want my government to put in the kind of policies that would allow me to have one. Because if today I could buy a car that I could plug into my home at almost $4 a gallon gasoline, I can assure you that I will be cheaper for me to plug in my car and drive 10 miles off the battery than it would be to buy gasoline.
We have a number of callers here. I want to try to get them in the time that remains. Let's get to it. Urbana Line 1 is next up. Hello.
Am I the one?
Yes.
Yeah. We talk always about how many miles per gallon automobiles get, and the U.S. is certainly wedded to automobiles, as we heard in the last hour or two. But I was flying the other day, and people were talking about plane consumption and saying that just to get an airplane off the ground takes a terrific amount of oil to get it into the air, and if it's a big one, it takes a fair amount to get it from New York to San Francisco or London or wherever. I've never heard anybody except the airlines say that they had to raise their prices, but I've never heard anybody talking about oil, talk about how much consumption, what percentage of oil consumption is in the airline industry, which is rather heavily subsidized in comparison with light rail or anything like that.
Well, it's what we call a small part of the barrel. So when I take a barrel of crude oil and I bring it to a refinery, you know, what percentage do I get of which product? So about 50% of the barrel or 45% of the barrel goes to gasoline. Probably another 20 or 30% is going to go to diesel or heating oil, right? And then the other products I'm going to get are going to be jet fuel, which you mentioned, and something called fuel oil, which is sort of a bunker. I might use it to burn in a power station, probably not so much in the United States, but in other countries, or it's used for, you see a big tanker or a big cargo ship.
Yeah.
Use the fuel for that. So, jet fuel is actually a very small part, an important part, but a very small part of the oil business from the point of view of people selling oil.
I see, because I was misled to think that it was a very large part that nobody talked about.
Well, if you're in the airline industry, it's an astronomical part of your cost structure. So I've seen some of the airline industry people, the chairman and so forth, on television being interviewed, and I, you know, we could get to a point where it's just so expensive that this sort of, I'm not going to drive from Houston to Dallas, I'll just pop in a plane.
Right.
That kind of, you know, Southwest Airlines, I'm taking an airline instead of driving a distance, that kind of travel might end, and the whole going to grandma's house might become a very expensive trip. I mean, we've been very lucky as Americans. You pretty much, if you could plan ahead, you could go anywhere in this country for $200-$300 a ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't see oil prices ease back down, I think that sort of day of mobility, of cheap mobility, I mean, those days may be behind us a little bit, and you may see people having to stay home a little more. It might be a little bit more like after September 11, where people chose to stay home.
Right.
You may have people choosing to stay home because the cost of travel becomes prohibitive.
Yeah. And then, of course, the trains are much more economical than trucks, too, so transporting.
The trucking industry is going to be hit. You know, you and I are paying for the trucking industry. It costs more to ship goods around, so when you go to buy food and when you go to pick up goods that were manufactured someplace else, you're paying more, and part of that is the cost of transporting those goods. Now, we've been in a very interesting pattern in the world, right? And it's a pattern that maybe we should change, not only because, you know, the prospects for how much oil there is left under the ground, but also because we care about the global climate. So we in America have become very used to, and in other countries the same, that if we really like peaches, and, you know, it's out of season in the United States, you know, somebody flies those peaches in from Chile every day.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And that is very oil-intensive, and it's also very carbon-producing. So if you think about your own personal carbon footprint, you know, buying meat from Argentina, or, you know, we had an event the other day at Rice University, and we were all laughing because we're all very sensitized about this carbon footprint issue. The caterer brought bottled water from New Zealand. I mean, that is unacceptable. Right?
Right.
I mean, first of all, we have bottled water right here in Texas. And second of all, you know, maybe we should just be taking it out of the tap. So there are a lot of things that we're doing that we're not thinking through. We're buying food from all around the world because we'd like to have this pasta that's made only in this one place in Italy, right, or olive oil from Greece. But, you know, we might get to the point where we really can't afford that lifestyle, that maybe we need to be just eating foods that are, you know, produced here and fruits and vegetables when they're in season. I mean, when I was a little girl, you know, my mother served what was in season. Now there's no such concept as a fruit or a vegetable being, quote-unquote, in season, right? But all of these things that we do unconsciously and we don't think through, all of these things are very fuel-intensive, and we have never had to think about it because fuel was cheap, and we weren't worried about the carbon output of burning all that fuel. But as we move forward, I think we're going to find that we're going to have to live in, if not in a different lifestyle in the sense that maybe we're not going to go to smaller homes. I mean, it's hard for me to predict on that. But maybe commuting an hour and a half by car back and forth to work is not going to be, you know, as attractive a lifestyle it's as it's been in the past when fuel was cheap. And maybe buying fruits from South America that are exotic and interesting to eat are just going to be too expensive for the average American.
We just have a couple of minutes left. I want to thank the last caller and try to get one more, and this would also be Urbana in line two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I switched on very late, so I don't know if you handled this issue before. This has to do with our domestic policies. We portray ourselves to be the leader of a market-based economy, and we lean on other countries to open up their markets and cut their subsidies. A few months ago, I guess, there was a speaker from the ethanol industry here who was asked what price ethanol would have to be before subsidies can be done away with, and this gentleman was pretty much irate about that question. His argument was that if the state is going to subsidize oil industry, why not we? And I would like you to take a shot at that, whether we do subsidize the oil industry, whether we do it directly and to what extent, and what role does our subsidizing of the energy industry play in all of this in keeping our demand so high?
Yeah. And I have to tell you, Ms. Jaffe, that I can give you about 2 minutes to explore what is obviously a very complicated question.
It is a very complicated question. I think we all can see that subsidizing farmers to grow corn to make it into fuel was not a good idea. I mean, I think that getting it unraveled has to do with the problems of the, you know, presidential primary system and so forth. So maybe we're not going to be able to rescind it, but it was definitely a mistake. And, you know, we've seen in Congress the same debate about whether the oil company should be given tax breaks for drilling complicated systems off the Gulf of Mexico when they're making so much money. So I would say in both directions, in today's world, I don't think either group needs a subsidy. Both groups are profitable, and if these corn guys can't make money selling it as fuel, they should be selling it as food, right? So, and we shouldn't have a tariff, since we all know, because it's been explained on CNN and your show, NPR, and other stations, that it's much more efficient to make ethanol from sugar. And since we have many allies in South America and the Caribbean that are able to grow sugar and turn it into ethanol, why we would put a trade protection to protect our sugar industry is also beyond me. I mean, why not just, you know, bring in the maximum amount of sugar-based ethanol there is from Brazil and Central America and the Caribbean, and, you know, let the best man win. If the corn guys can't produce a competitive product that is better or cheaper than sugar-based ethanol, then sugar-based ethanol is what we should be using. So there are a lot of inefficiencies built into the market because of political lobbying. And so we Americans need to stand up and say, I am not willing to pay more at the pump to subsidize people in Iowa.
Well, we're at the point where I think we're going to have to stop with much more to be said about energy policy. Perhaps we can find other ways to talk about it on other days. But for right now, we're pretty much going to have to finish up. Certainly, if people are interested in reading up on some of these issues, you can go to the website of the Baker Institute Energy Forum at Rice and take a look at what's there. Our guest, Amy Myers Jaffe, is the Wallace Wilson Fellow in Energy Studies at the James Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice. She is also Associate Director of the Rice University Energy Program, where she does research on things like oil geopolitics and energy economics and energy policy. And Ms. Jaffe, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, and to your listeners as well.